And this is supposed to do something, so we'll find out. No, that's why I brought Jim. So I would like to thank Jim for driving. It was great. I was a passenger. I was just driving down and saying, oh, look over there. And, this place looks just like Fairfax. So I'm up in Northern Virginia. My home group's the Old Town Speakers Group in Old Town, Alexandria. My sobriety date's the 13th of October, 1994. I've had many a sobriety date. In fact, my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous was in 1988, tomorrow, September 19th, 1988, is I went to the first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that I attended, that I remember that I went to. And so that's 88. My sobriety date's 94. So obviously, I am not a first nighter. In fact, I had no idea what Alcoholics Anonymous was about when I first attended it. I did not want to stop drinking. What I wanted to do, I wanted magic. I wanted to stop having the problems I had when I drank. I wanted those to go away and just to stay as drunk as I had always had for years and years before that. And there's no magic in this program. Lots of miracles, no magic. And I'm happy to say that finally I recognized the miracle in 1994. I will keep it to the way the big book suggests, what it was like, what happened, and it says what we are like now is, I'm not sure what y'all are like now, but I can tell you to the best of my ability what I'm like now is I don't jump around because I just get confused and trip over my feet and would make even less sense than I normally do, so I'll keep it real linear, you know, that works out best. So I'm an Army brat, so it has nothing to do with my drinking. Because my two brothers are not participants in this program, and they moved everywhere I did. My parents aren't here, and they moved a lot of times before we did. So it's being an Army brat had nothing to do with being a drunk. I don't go into my ancestry because, again, that's got nothing to do with my alcoholism. So whether I had ancestors who died drunk in a ditch or not has nothing to do with my drinking and the disease that I carry right now. In fact, I learned out of the third step, I don't really care why I'm an alcoholic. I don't care. Why is a God question? That's a management question. I'm not in management. I was told to surrender the management in the third step, and I've done that, so I don't even care why I'm an alcoholic. All I know is I am an alcoholic, and then what's proper for me is, what are you going to do about it? Now, for the longest time, as I answered that question in not very socially appropriate manners, we'll put it that way. But I grew up in the Army, moved around a lot, so I knew about geographic cures long before I ever had my first drink. And I remember thinking, once we get out of Okinawa, everything will be fine. It's this foreign country. It's once we're out of Carlisle Barracks, Pennsylvania, everything will be fine. It's once we're out of Fort Sam Houston, everything will be fine. Once we're out of Fort Eustis, everything will be fine. It was always the next place, the next duty station is where I'm going to start feeling comfortable. Because somewhere along the line, what happened is I didn't like going out that front door. Because I convinced myself, in my head was talking to me, something bad's going to happen out there. You know, not bad run over by a car, but bad you're going to have to go to school and you're going to fail the test again. And you're a dummy. You're never going to learn anything. No one likes you. You never get the joke. You're never going to have money. You're never going to have a good job. Yammer, 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 yammer. And that's what my head was telling me all the time. Delusional, because nothing out there corresponded to what was going on in my head. But I'd listen to my head. So I just, you know, I'd kind of walk out and I just every day I was just kind of hunching up as if this were some sort of fight I was in and that I wasn't a very good fighter. So that's what I brought to my first drink of alcohol, which was at MacDill Air Force Base down in Tampa, Florida, in the early to mid-60s. I'm a history major, and I always listen to speakers and try to place them and all that. So I'll get that out of the way for you. I was born in 1951. I'm 54 years old now. I stopped drinking when I was 42. Never been married. I'm a bachelor. No kids that I know of. And I got a dog. So that's we got that all taken care of, so you don't have to concern yourself with that anymore. I was 14 years old, I think. So it was just after the Cuban Missile Crisis, and there was a lot going on in MacDill. So they had a lot of, you know, combat air patrols and lots of things happening and lots of people down at that installation. And one Friday night is I just decided I was going to drink. Now, I've been around drinkers all my life. My folks to this day, my mom's 89, my father's 87. At the cocktail hour, is my mom has a little shot of sherry, about like that, and my father has a scotch and soda. And my father used to have half a bottle of wine at dinner. And so I've been around drinkers. I used to mix his drinks for him. So I knew about drinkers, and I knew about cocktail parties. And I didn't drink the way I had ever seen anybody drink in my life. Now, I don't remember that I said, I want to find out what this drinking thing is. You know, I don't, no conscious thought, as far as I'm concerned, or that I can remember at all, is I just hit the liquor cabinet and started on the left and worked my way over to on the right. Because I had no idea of whiskey, bourbon, vodka, gin, you know, the green stuff, which I found out later was cream de menthe, you know. And I blamed the cream de menthe for what happened to me later on and avoided the green stuff until I founded NyQuil, you know, until they invented NyQuil. Because when I was coming up, there was no such thing as NyQuil. But a lot of times when I was in the Army, that's you could either get NyQuil or Aquavelva. With an alcohol content, is the cooks kept all the vanilla extract for themselves. So that's where I got introduced to NyQuil. And, you know, if you're not done drinking, NyQuil, it's 50 proof, it'll do the trick. And if you got a cold, it'll do something with that, too. So, you know, just a thought. But I got thoroughly trashed on this night, and I don't remember much of what happened. I don't think I had a blackout. But I remember crawling around, and I couldn't lift up my head, and everything was spinning around. Had a horrible hangover the next day, and the Tampa, Florida weather is exactly like Washington, D.C. weather in the summer. Hot and humid, and it rains for 5 minutes and then stops, and the road steams for the rest of the evening. And I was sicker than a dog, and I was just walking around, and I don't ever remember saying, I'm not going to do this again. Because the following Friday, I did the exact same thing, except I laid off the green stuff. See, I was already trying to control what I was doing, that I liked that outcome, because the outcome that I got from the drinking was this head that didn't much like me went somewhere else. Everything changed in my head. It was suddenly great to be where I was right at this moment. That's why I drank when I was 14 years old, and that's why I drank when I was 42 years old. If nothing else, I was consistent through that. Is it always calmed down my mind. Now, along with that delusion was the reality that I knew nothing was changing out there when I drank. I've heard a lot of speakers talk about when they drank, they thought they were taller, better looking, smarter, richer, funnier, a better fighter, a better lover, some of that. I was not under that impression. You know, I had no, I knew that nothing was changing out there, but I knew my head changed when I drank, and that was fine by me. And that set up the pattern of my drinking. I drank by myself. I was never a social drinker, you know. Teenager, you get a case of beer with your buddies and drive around, drink beer and throw the cans out the window and hoot and holler at the girls. I didn't do that. I got my own whiskey. I just felt better having having a quart of my own that I didn't have to share with anybody, that I didn't have to talk to anybody. And I'd go sit in Tampa, watch Tampa Bay, watch the waves roll in and just drink until I became a winner in my own mind. After about 3 weeks, my father noticed the levels of the booze going down. So we're a quiet family. We don't confront each other. But suddenly there was a lock on the bar. So I realized that source was gone. And see, he did a lot of official entertaining, so this was all taxpayer-bought liquor. Thank you very much. My first couple of drunks was at your expense. And then I bought my own. I had a little nothing, jobs here and there, and so I could always get enough money to buy Old Heaven Hill bourbon, $2.95 a quart. So, I still think it's $2.95 a quart. In fact, on the Travel Channel a couple months ago, I saw that the Heaven Hill distillery that makes Old Heaven Hill burned to the ground. I was fascinated. It's in Kentucky or so, and I was just sitting here watching this distillery just burning to the ground. I mean, they had something like 1 million gallons of this stuff. It burned pretty nice, but I said, I did the best I could putting a dent on that. I was a weekend warrior. We got transferred up to Washington. I went to school the last 2 years of high school up there. Still drank by myself. Barely graduated out of high school. Was introduced to the morning drink. Because at the time when you were 18, you could buy beer and wine in D.C., and without giving it a second thought, I was walking from the bus stop, the metro wasn't there yet, from the bus stop to school, and I passed this little bar. I was going, wait a minute, why don't you have a couple beers before you go to school? It certainly couldn't hurt, and it's not going to, it won't help, but it's not going to hurt. And I knew that drinking made me feel better. So without giving it a second thought that there was, that I didn't see any other students in there ever. I hardly ever saw anybody in there. But this guy was open, and so I'd start having a couple Budweiser and a glazed donut. That was breakfast. And then I'd just kind of sit there and wonder why they're torturing me in this school. It was way beyond my intellectual abilities, that's for sure. But I graduated, surprised everybody and graduated, 151 out of 157. So there were 6 people that were lower than me in the class standings. I just kind of wonder where they are, you know. They probably own software companies up in Fairfax and are worth millions of dollars. But I escaped high school, and 1 week later I was in the Army. Now, the night I had gone to bed, as the Army had never come up in my mind to go into the Army. This was during Vietnam, and it wasn't really Vietnam, but I just hadn't thought about the Army. And it suddenly occurred to me, when I was kind of laying there in bed, waiting for the bed to quit spinning around, that I didn't want to go to college because I figured it was high school writ large, and I didn't want that. So I said, why don't you go in the Army? Next day, I was in the Army. You know, I was like that frog you touch that electric current to and his leg twitches. You know, why don't you do that? And so I was in the Army. I was a medic. Luckily, my first orders were to Europe, and that's where the booze started catching up to me in real terms. Blackouts started then. Getting in trouble with the military, losing stripes, getting confined, getting pulled out of the stockade, wrecking vehicles. That's where it started. But I did not give a thought to not drinking. You know, it was just, it's just bad luck, or, geez, you know, everybody I knew seemed to be getting arrested, so it didn't seem to be a big deal. Once again, I wasn't brought up that it's just fine to get arrested. So I start, this is consequences of the drinking that I paid not a second thought to. Didn't think about it at all. I then went to college because I didn't want to work. I don't like working. I just, it's never been one of my fond ideals was, boy, I want to get up every day and work hard. That's never been part of it. So I figured I could hide out in college, and, you know, I just pretty much stayed drunk. Picked a school out of a book because it had the same name as my high school. There was no other reason in the world that I went to that school. And I said, oh, I've never been out in the Northwest. I recognize the name. I'll go out there. So it was nice in Spokane, Washington. I thought it was Spokane until I got there, and they said it's Spokane. So I just hung out in Spokane for close to 5 years. Graduated in 4, believe it or not. Now I was an English and history major, so it isn't as if I were employable with my degree or anything, but I didn't much care. I hadn't given a thought to employment. You know, because I was bringing in money, I had a small import business of South American agricultural products, you know, and that seemed to be pretty good money. But, you know, in Washington, the state prison's called, it's in Walla Walla, Washington, the town they like so well, they named it twice. And I just looked, and I got to thinking and saying, you know, I really don't want to be Bubba's girlfriend. I just don't think I'm made out to go to prison. And this was a time where they popped you with dope and you went away for a long time. So I gave up what I thought was the best job I'd ever had. I said, I'm good at it. They don't even realize I'm shorting them on everything. You know. But I had to get out of that business. And I thought I ought to get paid to stay out of everybody's way. I said, you know, I think I'm basically just a pain in the elbow, so why don't they just send me a check to just stay out of everybody's way, just enough to have some ratty little apartment, stay drunk, get cigarettes and a car. You know, that's what I wanted to do. But also, too, by this time, I was fighting the booze. It happened when I was 24 years old. As I remember, one day I'd... a very nice girl had given me the ultimatum, it's either me or the drinking. And it took a good, you know, 5-6 seconds to say goodbye to her, you know, that I just, you know, she was nice, but I knew she didn't do for my head what the drinking did. And also it was another person. And I was too selfish to give time to another person. And I had recognized that women seem to demand a lot of your time. They also want you to remember what they say to you and you say to them. And they get really upset if you disappear for 3 or 4 days and then decide sleeping on the living room floor is just fine. They don't see it as being just fine. So I said, very nice, Marge, bye-bye. And I stayed drunk for 3 or 4 months over that, really drunk. And this one day I said, I have got to take a break. I think it was the kind you just poured in so much booze, there's just no place for it to go. And I remember it was a Saturday, and I said, I'm not going to drink today. Today I'm just not going to drink. And Sunday morning I was in the Bulldog Tavern in Spokane, Washington, knocking back a hangover beer. And I had no idea how I'd gotten drunk the day before. Because I wasn't going to drink. No idea. And I was staring at myself in the mirror they put behind the bar for the drunks to stare at themselves at and think. And I had a moment of clarity. I know now it was God revealing the truth to me, and I recognized some of that truth. And the truth that I could recognize is what I heard in here was, Doug, you are a drunk. And I accepted that 100%. I didn't fight it. I didn't try to convince myself I wasn't. I knew I was a drunk. But that's all I knew. That was the truth. And then it was my delusion kicked in and you're going to die drunk. Because I didn't know there was any way. I thought if you were drunk, you drink until you die drunk. Because Spokane's an old railroad town and close to the Spokane Indian Reservation. So I'm used to seeing old drunks wandering around. Old railroad men and dudes off the reservation, just that's an old drunk. And I figured that's what was going to happen to me. And I said, what I got to do is get enough money to stay as drunk as I have to be until I die. That's what I decided in that bar. And one and three worked. Two, I'm not dead of alcoholism yet. So as long as I keep doing what I've been taught to do, that'll never kick in. But I lost nothing financially from drinking. None whatsoever. Not a thing. Because after that, it was legitimate jobs, and I guess I do have enough on the ball that I can get money. That was never a problem. And I stayed just as drunk as I wanted to get. And I never came close to running out of money. What I gave away, what I stripped off year after year, were little pieces of my soul. That's what I gave up. Little by little, I gave up my soul. There wasn't a day that went by for the next 17 years after that revelation that I didn't fight booze. That booze wasn't front and center in my mind when I swam up the consciousness or woke up. Every day, the booze was there in some form. Usually it was trying to get over a drunk. After a couple years, I no longer lied to myself and said, oh, I'm not going to drink today. I quit telling myself that lie because I couldn't do it. I was drinking every day. And the booze had me. That's when I recognized I had a problem, and that's when the fight began. And it was a 17-year battle that I didn't win at all. Even when I wasn't drinking, when I was so physically sick I couldn't drink. Or a few other times and I would attempt to quit. The booze still had me because that's all I could think about. I couldn't pay attention and live my life because I was too sick or devastated or concentrating on the booze. The alcoholism was right there, and I belonged to that alcoholism every day. And I knew it now. But I didn't think there was any way out of it. So I drifted in and out of schools, drifted into the Army again. That was Austin, Texas. It suddenly occurred to me one night, after I'd switched to 10 High whiskey by now, after drinking a fair amount of 10 High whiskey, that I ought to go back in the Army. This time I was a Russian linguist. You know? I'm no good at languages. Why would I want to be a Russian linguist? You know? No worse than a medic. I'm not especially fond of gunshot wounds and all the other stuff, you see. So I don't want to be a medic. I think I read a Sergeant Rock comic book, and that was good enough for me. And, you know, the recruiter saw a live one and said, oh, yeah, 4 years, Russian linguist. Oh, okay, yeah. So I was a Russian linguist. That's why I switched to vodka. I figured if you're studying Russian, you drink vodka. So went out to Monterey to mess around with the military subset of Russian, and the Army was crazy enough to give me a very high security clearance, and then I got shipped off to Berlin when the Soviet Union was a going concern, and Berlin had a wall around it, and it was I fell into a job that I dearly loved the job that I had. There was a lot of analysis. It was military stuff that I had been around all my life that I could just pick up very easily. I dearly loved that job, and I couldn't do it well. Because, you know, you do something, you want to do something, what do you do with it? You dearly love doing something. You put in time, you put in effort, you put in study, you put in dedication, and I couldn't do that. No matter how much I wanted to, I had to drink. And when I drank, I didn't want to do anything. And that was the biggest disappointment, I think, of my drinking, was the hash I made of that job. Because, you know, I really liked it. Still got some of the old books, the non-classified, unclassified ones. You know, and I still dip into it from time to time. So that's where my last arrest came, was in Berlin. I was in a blackout the whole time. They didn't even know I'd been arrested. Didn't even know I'd been in the stockade. Didn't even know I'd been released. I just woke up in the barracks the next morning. And that's when I was told, and I didn't believe it. And then I got invited down to see the company commander and military police. And then I knew, uh-oh. I had to agree, okay, maybe I was arrested. And I didn't want to let on that I didn't remember that I hadn't been arrested, because you know, social drinkers and non-drinkers give you really weird looks when you say, well, I kind of lost between Thursday and Monday morning. They just have a hard time comprehending that. So I didn't want to let on, and I'd do one of these things, and I was told, if you get drunk one more time, we're going to put you out of the Army. Because this was back in, this was in the early 80s. By that time, the Army was recovering from Vietnam. They didn't need bums like me. They really didn't. The problem was, and I had seen a couple of the people that I used to drink with or listen to carouse, they got bounced out of the Army. And I didn't want that to happen. And because that was humiliation and shame. Because I kept thinking of my father. He was born in Iowa City of Czech immigrants. He was born on the kitchen table of their house. They had nothing. His father's dead before the Depression, all that stuff. And he retired a major general in the United States Army through his effort. And here's his youngest son who had had every advantage in the world, about ready to get thrown out as a buck sergeant. I was just humiliated. So I said, I can't drink. I had 4 months that I went dry. If I wasn't working, I just sat in the barracks, white knuckling it. You know? And I kept wondering, well, everybody's saying my problem's alcohol. Well, I'm not drinking. Why do I feel like I want to put a spike in my head? I couldn't figure that out. Kept thinking about it. So I like to think. I'm not good at it, and I'm certainly not systematic or logical, but I do like to think. And I just said, I got to hang in there as best as I can. Hang in there. You know, I'm hanging in there. I always cringe when I hear folks, when you ask them in an AA meeting how they're doing, and they say, I'm hanging in there. Ugh. You know, because I remember hanging in there. And at times I would just want to hang myself from a beam in my barracks. You know, because I couldn't see any way out. But it was like a jail sentence. You just have to get through 4 months, and I got through that 4 months, and I got drunk the night before I left Berlin and almost got arrested again. You know, it's a big book talks about you got a deal, you work on it, and then the day before, the big day, you screw it up, and that's what I did. I had to leave Berlin, and they were looking for me. You know, I just couldn't last. The last day, I had to screw it up. So, but I got out of the service. Haven't been back since. I think I'm too old now. So, I might make other stupid decisions, but that won't be one of them. Then I drifted into computers. Didn't think I'd be any good at them. Thought you had to be a math genius, white lab coat kind of guy, and I wasn't that. But you have to be just reasonably logical if you can see that one step follows after another step. You can do okay with it, which I could do. And I got that same job now with the same employer, federal government. You know, I'm happy to say it's a real drinking outfit. So if you manage to survive that first year probation, yeah, it's tough to get rid of you. If you went in and shot your boss in front of witnesses, they might have a problem with it. But other than that, you know, it's scary because I know, well, I'll leave that alone. But I said, this is great. I gotta straighten up and act better than I've been acting. And by the second week, I was calling in sick. I was just not coming in. The dress code was you'd be lucky if I bathed or shaved or combed my hair. It's more efficient if you wear clothes for 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 days. You know, you just don't waste time and have to make choices about what you pick up off the floor and wear. So by the second week, and this is when they could fire me in the probation period. So I wanted not to do what I was doing, but I couldn't stop. And now I'm in my 30s, and then I'm in my 40s, and my body's starting to fall to pieces from this. And I don't know how much I drank. I don't much care. I know I drank enough to do the trick. And absolute pepper vodka. If you don't like NyQuil and you're not done drinking, try Absolute Pepper Vodka. Put it in the freezer, drink it out of the freezer. It will set you up. And that's what I ended up on. I was deathly afraid I was going to run out. So I could never remember how much I had, so I was always going to the ABC store and get another couple bottles and putting it up in the freezer. And you know, when I hear people say I ran out of something to drink at 3 o'clock in the morning, I look at them and I said, you're a chump and you deserve to suffer. If you ran out, you didn't know what your primary purpose was, and you deserve to suffer. And all you do is you just go to CVS and buy some NyQuil until they open up the beer coolers or the ABC store opens up. So, I never ran out of booze. The shakes never left me. I just was always shaking. Just always shaking. It was so bad I couldn't sign mortgage checks. I had people writing the checks for all the stuff, the gas and electric and all that, the mortgage. I bought a house. I thought that would keep me sober, soberer than I was, because I figured you buy a house up in Northern Virginia, you're going to be so poor, you're not going to be able to drink. Well, you know, I bought this house and I put down a hefty down payment because I didn't want them screwing around with me on this mortgage stuff. So I owned half the house from the get-go. Like I said, I didn't lose anything financially. I was set up. There's no problem there. Then I went out. I said, I got to celebrate that I got a house. You know, this is the first house I've ever had. So, you know, ought to drink champagne to celebrate. Drank so much champagne I couldn't remember where the house was and had to sleep in the car out in the parking lot until the next day because it hadn't occurred to me I could look in all these papers I had and it would have the address. So I just slept in the car. And the house didn't keep me sober. Sad, but it didn't keep me sober. Didn't my poor neighbors too. Because I'd do my yard work at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. You know, because I'd be sitting there drinking vodka thinking that I really hated this tree, you know, and I'm going to do something about it right now. So, and they weren't big trees, it was just townhouse trees, you know, not like a big oak tree. But there'd be the fifth out on the stoop, and here I am at 1 o'clock in the morning wailing away at this tree with an axe. That was the only garden implement I had. Or sleeping out in the backyard or taking out shrubberies or getting confused and taking down my neighbor's little tree in his front yard. But it's just, you know, that wasn't working too well. But so shaking all the time. I was blacking out 4 or 5 times a week. So I made up for not blacking out the first couple of years I drank. Bruises all over my body, not from falling down. My liver was shutting down. And you'll notice that for a lot of drunks who are getting up in their late 30s and 40s, their livers aren't processing the booze the way it used to. And all that the booze and the poison just kind of leaches out. You just suddenly will have a big bruise on your side where you didn't fall down, or bruises on your legs, or bruises on your head where you did fall down. It didn't really make a whole lot of difference. And I was noticing that I'd be coming out of blackouts and my .38 would be loaded on the nightstand. And I didn't sleep with a loaded .38 on the nightstand since I wasn't selling dope anymore. I hadn't in 20 years. So sometime in a blackout, I'd taken out the weapon and loaded it up. And Lord knows what I'd done with it. Now, to show how delusional and how divorced from reality I was, it never occurred to me to put the ammunition or the weapon in another part of the house. It never occurred to me to sell the weapon. All I could do was hope I wouldn't blow myself away in a blackout. That's all I could do. Nothing else occurred to me what to do with a problem of maybe playing with the .38 loaded in a blackout. That's all I could do. I was terrified every morning when I woke up. Every morning. It was awful. You know, and I just think, I got to do this again. Today's the day they're going to fire me. They're going to realize for the past 10 years they made a very bad mistake and I don't know anything about computers. That's what my head was telling me. Out there, I knew plenty about computers. worked on mainframe operating systems. Time was 6 or 7 million lines of code. It went up every year for a major federal agency. Think April 15th, and you know what agency that is. I hated paying taxes to my own boss. I thought I'd get an employee discount, you know, something like that. I used to do mine April 14th. I'd sit there on the rug and have a fifth with me and drink this and get madder and madder that I had to pay taxes. And when I got sober, I looked at some of the stuff I sent in. I went, holy smoke! It was just insane, you know. And they got a special unit out in Cincinnati that audits IRS employees, and it's like I was doing everything I could to get fired. Didn't cheat on it because all my stuff was obviously documentable, but I mean it was just a scrawl, and I'd put little notes to them on there that I probably shouldn't have put on there. Yeah. So I was just shot. You know, physically I was shot. I had no idea when I started to drink what was going to happen, how much I was going to be able to drink. I might have a beer and a peach schnapps, for God's sakes, you know. Yeah, where does that come from? And go into a blackout. You know, I should have thrown up or shot myself rather than drinking that. Or I might drink a whole fifth and disappear for a week. I had no idea what would happen when I started to drink. My tolerance was up and down, completely gone. I was drinking, and I didn't care when I started drinking. I didn't care when I always had a plan when I was going to end to drinking, but it rarely worked out. I just had no idea once I started drinking what was going to happen. And spiritually, I was running from God. I knew there was a higher power. I knew he didn't like what was going on, but I figured he's the one who made me a drunk and he was punishing me for something. That's the best I could do in my theology department. I was under no impression, too, while I was running that I could hide from God. So I was having a real problem with God in my head. You know, I'm saying, well, at least I'm not committing suicide. My head would be more delighted to tell me, what do you think drinking yourself to death counts as? Yeah. Okay. Spiritually bankrupt. Mentally, I was terrified all the time. Physically, I was falling to pieces. And that's what I brought to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was September 19th, 1988. And I had no idea what Alcoholics Anonymous was. It sounded ominous. It sounded for losers, you know. And I didn't put myself in that category because I could point to the house and the job and the bank account and the credit cards. And I wasn't a fire barrel drunk. So I knew I was drinking myself to death and hated myself every day for doing it. But I wasn't a loser. I think it was about my fourth or fifth meeting when I realized these people are talking about not drinking a lot. They're talking about not drinking all the time, every day, forever. They can do this one day at a time. I know what they're talking about. And I saw no way I could do that. Because I knew what happened. I'd known that 4 months. I'd known a couple days when I'd try to get sober. I knew the way I felt. And I couldn't see doing that my whole life. And I became a tourist in AA for the next 5 years. I believe that thing, just don't drink and go to meetings. That was my program. My program consisted of parking my behind in a chair and not drinking. I had no idea that the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous constitute the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Read that book, Drunk and Sober, and never knew that. Never heard it. I looked at the steps on the wall, you know, off the wall program, you kind of looked at the steps, and in about 5 minutes I decided 9 of the 12 had nothing to do with it, or I'd already done it, and the other 3 didn't pertain to me. So, for whatever reason they had those up on the wall, it had nothing to do with me. And I could not see that what would happen is I would sit in that chair. I like the first couple days when you're still hallucinating and detoxing because time goes by. Time doesn't exist. It's great. You know, I love those first couple days, you know, because it didn't seem so bad. After that, it's the first after those first couple days, and when suddenly my head would start talking at me again, and my head would bring up every lousy thing that it could remember. It brought up all the shame and remorse that I felt for the way I'd wasted my life. It told me there was nothing I could do about it. It told me that I wasn't getting it the way these other people were getting it. Yammer, yammer, yammer. Talk, 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 talk. Every morning when I woke up, as my head would say, today is going to be exactly like yesterday. Exactly. Tomorrow is going to be exactly like today, and you can't even stand being on that planet. You're ready to jump out of your own skin. I would stand that just as long as I could. That feeling, that physical feeling that I had, the ants in my pants, the cayenne pepper all over your body just twitches and you just want to jump. And the craziness in the head. One time that came in 3 days, and I started fighting a guy on Shirley Highway right outside the Pentagon at rush hour. 3 days. And I jumped out and I was starting to wail on this guy in traffic. I'm not a wailer. I lost it. And then I just said, I'm going to get drunk. And as soon as I made that decision, I felt the relief. And then I hit my favorite bar. And I just felt more relief, and the bartender saw me coming and had that vodka out on the counter, and wham, and everything for the moment was all right with the world. And that's the way I was. White chips might last a week, might last a month. One time I lasted 14 months, hanging in there, hated every minute of it. So that's what happened when I was a tourist. And I'd be doing that today. Because of my power, I am nothing. I demonstrated enough to me that I am powerless over alcohol and that my plan will kill me. Falling back on my own resources, there was nothing there. You can't buy sobriety. People try that. You can dry out, but you can dry out for free. You know, you're not going to buy it. I certainly didn't think I deserved it. I've said, I can't do this. I would be drunk or dead today except my higher power intervened. And that intervention came on the 13th of November, 1993. My last drink of alcohol was the 12th of November, 1993. Now, it's 11 months to the day before my sobriety date, and that isn't because I was on the marijuana maintenance program or anything like that. And I'm not prescribing for anybody. We've got a pamphlet over there that talks about it. Unless you happen to be an MD, then you can go ahead and prescribe for people. But I don't have an MD, so I'm not going to do it. But my experience is I was taking a legally prescribed medication that was inappropriate to my spiritual dis-ease. What I was looking for still was a chemical solution to a spiritual problem. The day I took spiritual action for the spiritual dis-ease that I have is the day I marked my sobriety. But I had an overwhelming spiritual experience the 13th of November, 1993. I woke up in Fairfax Hospital out of a 2-day blackout. And that was my plan. Today, my plan at 42 had put me flat on my back in Fairfax Hospital. That's the best I could do with what I brought to the table. And on the nightstand was the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. The man who would be my sponsor had brought it to me the previous night. I'd call him up in a blackout. He knew where I was. He came immediately. And I was out cold. So he left the book there and said, you know, I'll be back tomorrow. And that Saturday afternoon, I came awake and I saw that Big Book. And now I had no plan. I picked up that book and opened it at random. I had no favorite passage in the Big Book. I wasn't looking for anything. And I opened it up to page 30. the first chapter, or the first page of the third chapter, more about alcoholism. And I read a couple sentences off of that page that I had read drunk and sober. But nothing had ever made an impression. And it started where it was talking about the great obsession that we have. That illusion that we can control and enjoy our drinking. Now I had never, now I know, is I never could put those two together. I could control it or I could enjoy it. I couldn't do both of them. And it talked about the persistence of this illusion is astonishing. And it talks about what we have to look forward to, the gates of insanity or death. And then it said, we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. Still can't do it. And the obsession to drink was simply gone. That's why I have to die. It was simply gone. And it has never come back. And for me, this is the value of a sponsor because my sponsor told me what had happened. All I knew was I read those sentences and I felt light in my soul for the first time in decades. I knew something had happened, but I had no idea what it was. The value of a sponsor is when I told him this, he put his finger on it in 10 seconds. He said, you have finally taken the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous. You have surrendered. And my experience has been when I surrendered, the obsession was simply gone. And you know, I'm not talking about, gee, it'd be nice to have a drink. You know, that's nothing. I mean the kind where you are literally pounding your head on the wall saying, if I don't get a drink soon, I am literally going to beat my head through this wall. Where I have broken my fingers slamming it against walls, anything, so I wouldn't think about having, I've got to drink. That's never come back. As nothing that I did other than drink like a pig for close to 30 years and put myself in that hospital bed. That was my part. The relief from the obsession to drink is God's part. Why? I do not care. Why it happened to me the way it happened? I do not care. I'm not going to give it a second thought. That's none of my business. That's a God question. All I know is it's been done. And what am I going to do to keep it? Because the sponsor also pointed out to me, Greg said, these steps that everybody else has been talking about? And I knew then that the steps would set me free. Because I had that spiritual experience taking that first step that I didn't even know I was taking. I didn't even know it. And that can still bring tears to my eyes 11 plus years later. Just thinking of that, I was hopeless. I was dead. And it was simply gone in 30 seconds. Now, I didn't even know it was coming. And it was over. I wanted to take those steps. I admire people who take these steps on faith that have to struggle with that obsession to drink in Alcoholics Anonymous, who do what they're supposed to do and keep putting one foot in front of another on faith alone that this obsession will be gone. Because I could do it on trust. Because I had already had the experience of that overwhelming spiritual reaction from the first step. I knew this work. I wasn't doing it on faith. I was doing it on trust. And I took those steps. And we all have our favorite steps. Mine, 1, 3, and 11. Obviously 1, because it saved my life. 3 because 3 tells me I'm out of management. And I look at it and I said, I did an awful job of managing my life for 42 years. Yeah. Where it counted. When you wake up and wish you had never woken up, you've got a bad manager, get rid of them. And what I can say to myself now a lot is, what business of it is yours? And that keeps me out of a whole lot of trouble, and I have limited intellectual firepower, and I don't have to waste it on things that have nothing to do with me. That's good for me to know. What's management? Not me. And what am I to do? Which keeps me focused towards action, because I'm focused more towards sitting. So I've got to keep myself focused on that action. And 11, because it's one of those things is where I've had some really amazing things happen in meditation, where I thought it used to be, you know, the kind of guru stuff and Indian stuff or sainthood or something like that. And it hasn't been that at all, but I've just had some wonderful experiences meditating, usually when I'm out walking my dog, who I'll tell you right now is one of the gifts of sobriety for me. It's because I always wanted a dog, but I could never have one because I recognized what would happen to that poor critter when I was drinking. So my dog is one of the joys of my sobriety. And a lot of good things when I've been out walking him. In the early morning when I can just wipe my mind out and I can let it drift, and it seems that it latches on to something good more times than not. And that's, now I know it's simply taking the action, give it a shot, get rid of the old ideas of what you had about meditation, because your old ideas almost killed you. Just let it go. And I've gotten a lot more relaxed about living that I didn't have before. I was always tense and unhappy and thought this, I was about ready to go into a test, I was going to fail again. And I don't think that way most of the time. Now, it doesn't take much, and I can see how quickly I can get off the beam. And what I have to do is, my head wants to start yammering at me again. Well, you would think after 10 or 11 years you'd have enough of this stuff down and off it goes, you know. Why it works the way it does, I have no idea. My experience has been, those of us who stay in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous, who take action, who have a higher power, who pass this message on to the best of their ability, they're in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous, they don't get drunk. Stop doing that. And you start circling around Alcoholics Anonymous, and those people get drunk by the thousands every day. Which one do you want to be? 10-step says the problem has been removed. I love that. Love that more than a 9-step promise. The problem has been removed. Past tense, not is being removed. It has been removed as long as I take the action to get closer to my higher power and to pass this message on the best I can. So that's what I try to do today. And if I do that, I will never have to take a drink again. This is not a crapshoot. I'm not going to be struck drunk. It's only if I stop taking the actions I've been taught by those that I know and love in Alcoholics Anonymous, am I in trouble. And I am not willing to do that. Thank you very much for having me. Thank you.